Welcome to Western Skies, monthly news and culture magazine that takes a look at issues facing Colorado and the West. This month, we're talking about innovation. We'll hear about the nature of innovation.
You can have all the creative ideas in the world, but if you do nothing with them, they actually didn't matter.
Visit with some local independent inventors.
There are so many more millions of experimenters that are maybe just down the street from you.
And hear about how innovation is happening right in our own city government.
We found a way to measure innovation and put numbers behind it.
All that and more on this edition of Western Skies. Stick around. We'll be right back. Thanks for tuning in to Western Skies, a collaboration between the news department and the Big Something here at KRCC. I'm Andrea Chalfin. It was Thomas Edison who said, "Genius is 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration." Edison, of course, is one of the great American inventors. This month, we're delving into that equation with a look at innovation. Our roundtable this month features Eddie Sturman of Sturman Industries, David Amster-Olszewski, founder of the local solar energy company SunShare, and Nina Pollock, program executive for the Bachelor of Innovation degree at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. We begin with Nina and a definition of innovation.
We define innovation as the transformation of ideas into impact. So that's a process definition. Lots of things have to happen, from generating the ideas to making them real and having the impact.
Eddie?
The way I look at it, innovation is a process. Most people confuse inventions with innovation. Invention is just one step, one event in the beginning of the innovation process. But it's a long process from an idea to having a product.
David?
I'd say innovation is thinking outside of the box and then having the persistence to bring the ideas that you found outside of the box into the reality that we all live in and making those changes happen.
Eddie, you mentioned that innovation really is a process and that it's people confuse it with invention. And so do you then think that the word innovation is applied not enough? I mean, do you think that there's other ways that it should be applied?
No, I think people generally know. The definition itself doesn't concern me. And the aspects that do concern me, the process itself, that's very, very tough. Because if you're outside the box, it's against the flow of traffic. You're really fighting our culture. As we grow up, we're taught you cannot be different. And to get outside the box, you create enemies right off the bat because you disturb the comfort zone of the existing environment. So you have to be tenacious and never give up. Because people are afraid of change, especially if they make money. If you're trying to replace, let's say, oil with something that is sun energy, there are lots of people that are making money and they don't want you to do it. But if you believe in it and you do it, it's tremendous satisfaction. I love it. I just love it. But I expected it not to be easy. But we do need to change our culture. We've got to embrace changes because the world changes all the time. The only constant on this planet is change.
Nina or David?
One of the challenges we have when we're trying to teach students about innovation and the innovation process is this whole idea of, okay, you can have all the creative ideas in the world, but if you do nothing with them, they actually didn't matter. So yes, creativity is important, thinking outside the box is important, but it's not like there's a paucity of ideas. Ideas are everywhere. It's grabbing onto the idea that makes sense and actually putting it into some kind of implementation. That means you're talking about change processes all the time. How do cultures change? How do organizations change? How do nations change? And that becomes a part of innovation. I think people don't think about at first. They think about the invention or the creativity. And it's great to say, yes, we want to have an impact. But all of the stuff that happens in between that Eddie was just pointing out on how do you get people persuaded to try a new way? How do you bring people to a different point of view? All of that turns out to be, I think, one of the biggest challenges of innovation.
David?
Something that Eddie said really struck me. He spoke about tenacity. And as a young entrepreneur, I find myself, and I think the most recent time was yesterday, someone said I was referred to as tenacious. And I knew the person who was talking about me, and it wasn't meant as a compliment.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that's one of the interesting things that entrepreneurs or innovators or change agents, whatever you want to call them, have to face and deal with is this concept of we all appreciate change. Everybody, if you ask them if change is good, they'll say yes, most likely. But when faced with it truly themselves, changing some way or something, how they do things, it's a different story. And finding out how to make people comfortable with change, I think it's really a comfort issue. If people are comfortable with change, innovation will flow.
Mm-hmm. Eddie.
I really appreciate what you're saying. I was lucky. I was born in Israel. And you had to innovate to survive. We had nothing. I was born before Israel. It was called Palestine. And when I was 7 years old, Israel became a state. And the same evening, fighting started. Israel had no army, no way of defending itself. So innovation was a necessity. And that's the mother of invention, is necessity. When you have to have something, you're going to come up with solutions. And because I was born with this culture, I question everything. Why are we wasting water? And why are we wasting electricity? And there are so many things that we're doing because we never face having to do without it. But that's not how our kids grow up. Something happens to us as we grow up, and we don't even know it. They force you to conform. And that's how we're losing innovators.
Let's talk a little bit about what the measure is of when an idea catches on and how you know it's the right thing to move forward with.
When we look at innovation, you can innovate in many different ways. Okay, so you can be inside a large organization and still innovate. Entrepreneurship is a huge means toward making your innovation or your idea real. So a lot of people take that path in order to take their idea into the world. But the way you know if it's the right idea is you get out there and you start trying it. You talk to people about it. You build the prototype. You do the research. You figure out what's the next step, and you keep taking steps and learning from what the environment tells you so that you can take the next step and the next step and the next step. So I don't think there's a big magic to it, like there's some point in time where it says, that's the perfect idea, run with that one. I think it really is a learning process as well.
Mm-hmm. Eddie?
So we define sense with acronyms to the word sense. S-E-N-S-E. And the first letter is for simple. If you cannot explain your idea to a six-year-old, it's not a simple idea. And the second one is E, the second letter, which for efficient. Everything has to be efficient. Your time has to be efficiently spent, your money, everything. The next letter is the heart. It's the most important one. N for needed. a lot of people having great ideas that nobody needs. In innovation, defining that there is a need is the most important thing. When I find a situation that doesn't make sense to me, is there is a need for something to happen. And can I solve it with my experience, the tools that I learned? Can we stop global warming? First thing is there a problem? And if you say, yes, there is a real problem, then it's worth trying to go through the other letters, because it has to be all the things that I'm describing. So the next letter is safe. It has to be safe. There are lots of solutions that solve one problem, but they create other problems. And the bottom line in this society is it has to be economical. If it's not economical, if people will not spend their money to buy it, don't start with it. You're wasting your time. But if you meet all these criteria, then the idea makes sense.
Nina?
I would just add that it's sometimes difficult to determine if there's a need, because going out and asking people if there's a need doesn't always get you that answer. We don't know what we don't know. We don't know what would be useful. So some of the really big innovations that have changed our lives recently, such as smartphones, if you'd asked me in the 90s if I needed that, I would probably have said, no, I don't need that. But then it appears, and it's like, oh, okay, I see how I can make myself more productive or have more fun or stay in touch better or whatever I determine those needs to be. But you can't determine it by asking someone. So then you have to do like Eddie says. Now you're looking for what are the problems and how could I solve them, as opposed to, say, doing a focus group and asking people what they need. So it's not a simple process, I think, to determine needs. It requires astute observation and figuring out what the problems are and how you can make a solution fit.
David?
Sometimes a lot of it is listening. A lot of people ask me, did you come up with the idea of community solar gardens? You were the first company in the country that did this. And actually the answer is no, I didn't. And it took my mother telling me this idea for several months before I actually took it on. She said, well, we can't get solar on our house because we have trees covering it. But I still want to get solar panels, so how can I do that? Now, I was a little hard-headed. I should have taken it after the first time I heard it, but after I heard it three times from her and then I started talking about it with other people, you started to see that there's a need. But the actual idea didn't come from the entrepreneur. It came from the environment around the entrepreneur. And I think one of the other things, I don't know if we're going to start touching on, but is the community of innovation, and how do you build a community of innovation where entrepreneurs, creative people work together, have support systems, a mentorship program that helps facilitate this process? Because you can have an idea, but you need mentors to help you take that idea to the next level, to bring in experience from different areas, to actually make that idea, that impetus successful.
I think part of it is being an example. People, kids, don't see an example of success in innovation. They see it in sports. But so that's why we set up our place, to be an example of successful innovation. But it goes further than that. What we find, the longer they work in traditional places, the less innovative or creative they become. We got to a point where we decided we'll never hire anybody with experience. if they've got all these years of experience and they haven't created anything, it becomes negative. The team, one person that is negative will destroy any project. Special culture to promote innovation. But that gets into another real key element, is self-confidence. You really have to have people that they believe that they can be right and the rest of the world can be wrong, and not worry about the rest of the world. If the rest of the world would have solved the problem, you wouldn't even be thinking about it.
You know, I want to go back to something that you were talking about, and I think something that you said, Nina, and you said, Eddie, can go almost hand in hand on the same topic, which is you don't know that we need it until we need it, which is how something like the iPhone comes around and basically shifts culture. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there's something like global warming, which is there's a non-immediacy sort of association with that. So I'm wondering how do you know that you're going to give somebody something they didn't know they needed, or how do you show them they need something that they're not necessarily thinking about?
And the ways I think of it are, one, there's something wrong here. There's a problem. It needs to be fixed. So I'm going to go after fixing it. But the other way is there's something possible here. There's something better. It's not a big problem. Nobody's suffering. But I see a way it can be better. And I think when you talk about ideas and how do you know what the need is, I think you can look at it both ways.
David?
Something that I've thought a lot about is just the gut feeling. Do you have a gut feeling that something's right, that it's something that people will want? Is it something that you want to do? Being impulsive and being okay with being impulsive and embracing that. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of inventions that are out there are just somebody impulsively thinking about something and saying, I want that, I want to do that, I want to create that. And, you know, if you're talking about an iPhone or an iPad, well, I'd like to read my newspaper on something that I didn't have to throw away, and I'd like it to be available immediately. Well, you never would have thought about that. A lot of people wouldn't have thought about that, but somebody did. Somebody came up with it and made it happen. So what is that? How do you embrace that type of thinking? And I think there's some places where that's been done, Silicon Valley, Boulder, here in Colorado. And there's other places where that hasn't happened. But how do you create this culture of innovation whereby those ideas are supported? I visited Israel several years ago, and I think the whole country has a culture of innovation and change.
Exactly.
I mean,
there's cities.
Yeah. You know, their largest city, Tel Aviv, I think, is just this hub of innovation, of young people with new ideas. And it's okay to fail, because sometimes innovations fail. They don't always succeed. And it's embraced there. And how do you create cultures that promote innovation?
I think you hit on one of the really key things that has to be part of the culture, which is, what is your attitude toward failure? How do you deal with failure in an organization? How do you deal with failure? Somebody tries something and it doesn't work. If that means you get a bad performance review, if that means, you know, you get fired because you wasted company resources on doing something that didn't work. If that happens, then you're going to kill any possibility of a culture of innovation. So I think this relationship to failure is important in the culture. It's important in our systems, the larger systems, the societal systems we deal with. It's important for individuals. How are you as an individual with regard to failure? It ends up being a crucial element if you're going to build a culture of innovation.
How do you sort of reconcile some of these multiple forces that come in, either for, against, or neutral, but non-convinced of your ideas, to get them to work?
I think the first thing you do is you build up a core of people who support you and give you open and honest feedback, because people will always tell you that your ideas are crap, and that's just a given. So what you have to do is find those people who do support you and who keep you balanced.
Nina?
So I'm going to agree here with Eddie that things need to be economical, but that has two sides to it. They need to also be valuable. So I will pay more for something if I perceive greater value to it, or I will pay less for something that gives me the same value. But I'm always considering the value. But what I think you're getting to with the risks and the reward and the who prevents innovations from taking hold and so forth speaks to size and rules or systems, government's role, or where they have a role, where they don't. If you look at markets that can stay free, where people are allowed to experiment, where they can go try different ways of solving a problem, then the ways that make sense, according to Eddie's acronym there, the ways that make sense will tend to win out. What happens, though, is we sometimes get organizations that get really large, that get actually partnered with government, which is also really large at this time, that creates them a way to stay in place and resist change a lot. So we need to look to that. That's a systemic issue, so we need to look at, are we keeping the playing field the same for people? Are we favoring certain organizations over others, and for what purpose, for what reason?
Eddie.
Well, there are two sides to what you were saying. I'm going to talk about value in a second, but not all ideas are good ideas. But reality can get distorted. And so I'm okay with somebody saying, I have a better idea than yours, and I'm okay. That's great. Wonderful. So our egos and personalities get involved in our own creations. So I'm not against people killing ideas that should be killed. But the other is in value. That's a huge point that you brought up. It took me a while to realize we don't measure things the right way. It needs to be divided. I divide value into two parts. One is tangible, things that you can measure the economic value, return on investment. But I believe that the intangibles, things you cannot measure and put numbers on, are more valuable than the tangibles. You can do something that you cannot show how much profits you're going to make, but they're the right things to do. I gave an example. Do we have right to drill and take oil or gas out of the ground? People look at the numbers and say, oh yeah, we should take natural gas out, it's cheaper. But they don't look at the other value. First, do we have right to do it? Does it really belong to us? And if we take it, how about our children and grandchildren and other generations? How about the pollution side? There are so many aspects that you cannot measure. That doesn't mean that they're not valuable. They're very valuable. So what we do in our company is we emphasize the intangibles, like how beautiful the place is. Is it inspiring for people? And a lot of people in business don't get it, that if people are excited about what they're doing, they're going to get more productivity. If they work on something that they believe in, they're going to produce a lot more. You've got to use what we call the right road. Keep your values. And if you keep your values, numbers will work themselves out.
I guess finally, the one thing that I'm really curious about is sort of a personal motivation. And the second part of that question is, where do you kind of see the United States in terms of innovation moving forward? And are we going to maintain our status in this way? And if not, what do we need to do?
What motivates me is I really like to use my life the best way I can to make the world a better world. It's a personal thing that I want to do. I don't want to, just before I die, to say I should have done this, I should have done that. Life is a gift, and you can waste it or you can use it. So I'm trying to do the best I can, use my talent, experience, to make the world better. And in terms of the second part of your questions about countries, United States, I wish there would be no countries, no borders, and no titles. We're all the same, and we have to take care of everybody. If we do, then everybody's going to be better, including us. This society is not mature enough to just realize that there's more in common between us and the rest of the world than there are differences.
Nina?
Well, I started out as a kid reading science fiction from a very young age, and I loved it because it seemed, most of it, to have a view of possibility and a view of expansion. So that turned me into a technologist, and I studied engineering when I started. And at that time, I believed any problem we created, we'd be able to solve with technology. Learned over time that, ooh, that may not be all it takes because of what happens, the risks, people being resistant to change. So I went and studied change, organization development, and social psychology, and what is that about, and why do people behave the way they do. So when it comes to innovation, it's, for me, it's the perfect marriage. It's the marriage of an engineering background, a business background, a change and development approach, and it was perfect. So the chance to help educate students and influence students in a way that makes them more innovative, more prone to going out in the world and making something happen like David has done, or like Eddie has done, that's just really exciting to me. I also think that we can't stop what we're doing. We need to be smarter about it, but to say, nope, no more innovation, or let's go back to some old ways of doing it without looking at current circumstances and what we can now do, I don't think that leads anywhere good. So I think we have to keep going, but be hopefully smarter about it, more systemic, more systems thinking, if you will, and think about all of the impacts. In terms of where we are as a nation and how we're doing, that's an inherently competitive view. That suggests that we can't win unless others lose. And I don't buy into that. I think that we benefit, our country and our people benefit, as the rest of the world gets better at innovation.
David?
I'd say for me, it's all about the challenge. It's about the challenge to change things. I've never understood the word no. My mother always joked that about whether or not I actually had ears on my head when I was hearing the word. But overall, I'd say I'm very optimistic to your question about innovation in the United States. But because of what I've heard so far just around the table, innovators are incredibly optimistic people because they're free to think about what can be and the challenge of making that happen. And that's the path that I think that we're all on. If we can connect with each other, connect with people in other countries, take down the borders, the trade disputes, why do we need it? How do we start breaking down those barriers, have people working together, and have people challenging themselves? So much it's somehow people seem to be motivated about challenging others, competing against others. But what about competing against ourselves to become better people, to do things in better ways? Like Eddie was saying, to make the world a better place by being a better person. How do we make that happen? How do we get to that place? And I think the answer to that is we're getting there. We're going there. I think it's a social evolution.
That was Eddie Sturman of Sturman Industries, David Amster Olszewski, founder of the local solar energy company SunShare, and Nina Pollack, program director for the Bachelor of Innovation degree at UCCS. The full conversation is available online. Just click on Western Skies. We'll be right back. Thank you.
Me, oh me, oh my, I'm looking at the western sky.
Welcome back to Western Skies, where we're talking about innovation. I'm Andrea Chalfin. The amateur inventor has long been a central figure in the story of American innovation, embodying the entrepreneurial attitude and free-thinking spirit that this country was founded on. Though in recent history, innovation has increasingly become the prerogative of corporations, think tanks, and academic institutions, the amateur inventor still has important contributions to make. KRCC's Jake Brownell explored one Colorado Springs-based organization devoted to supporting independent inventors in southern Colorado. He has this story.
The Pikes Peak region holds a special place in the annals of innovation and invention, thanks in large part to one man, Nikola Tesla. Tesla, the father of radio, alternating current, and many other inventions, both practical and mythic, spent a brief period in Colorado Springs at the turn of the 20th century, experimenting with the wireless transmission of electric power. Though his stay here was short-lived, his presence in the region left a mark that shows no signs of fading more than 100 years after he abandoned his lab on North Foot Avenue. However, Tesla's brief tenure in Colorado Springs is more than mere fodder for history buffs. For many local inventors, Tesla is an inspiration, an adopted hometown hero whose legacy lives on in the work that they do.
My name is John McGinnis. I'm also known as JW, and I'm the president of the International Tesla Society.
McGinnis is one such local inventor and Tesla enthusiast, and his organization, based in Colorado Springs, provides advice, support, and resources for people who possess ideas but lack the institutional backing to see them through.
This is an organization that was founded back in 1984 with the goals of changing the world, in other words, bringing new technologies forward. And we pandered to the independent researcher and inventor. We knew we couldn't get the boys from, let's say, the university or the corporations, but there are so many more millions of experimenters that are maybe just down the street from you.
Myself and my family, we have dogs. And we struggled for years to keep our dogs off of the furniture and nothing worked. We would pile books and we would pile chairs and all kinds of things up there. So we came up with Couch Defender and Chair Defender.
Kathy Alberti, together with her daughter Alex and husband Gordon, worked with the International Tesla Society to develop the Couch and Chair Defenders, products designed to keep pets off furniture, now available in some local pet stores. Here's Alex.
It's like a giant slinky covered in a net. The ends are enclosed with two end panels on each side that slide in between the cushions and the arms.
The product simply takes up space on the couch. The beauty of the product is that also it folds to about an inch and a half, so it's really, really practical.
While the Albertis tackle an age-old pet dilemma, other members of the International Tesla Society are hard at work on products intended to improve the lives of people with physical disabilities. Jesse Gutierrez is an inventor living in Colorado Springs. He's been working with Stuart McQuillan, a paraplegic helicopter pilot who designed a product called the HeliLeg.
It is a fully functional skeleton that goes around the leg, so it has to be fully functional with a little bit of the person's body. Even if they have no, you know, from the knee down is completely cut off, they can still use the leg itself. That means that someone who's disabled and can't walk, who have no functions in their legs, can actually go back and get their pilot's license or have their pilot license and to go back into flying.
Gutierrez has also been working with fellow Tesla Society member Skip Juhas on another product for people with limited mobility. It's called the Handy Gas Helper. And it's a device that allows disabled drivers to signal to a gas station attendant that they need assistance filling up their tank. Here's Skip.
When you drive up to the filling station, you'll see the sign that says Handy Gas Helper, and it's got a number on it, 1 through 4. And you look at the number, push the correct button, and it'll beep inside. The person that's inside will come out and fill your gas up. In other words, it's like a little beeping kind of system and flashing system that allows you to get some help.
Though the scope of inventions produced by members of the International Tesla Society is broad, ranging from simple solutions to everyday problems to highly specialized and technologically complex products. It's that diversity that President J.W. McGinnis most values about the organization.
We're inviting people to just get out there and make a contribution, no matter how small. It is a contribution. It's part of the puzzle. People have been led to believe that their pieces don't mean anything. Well, they do.
For McGinnis, invention is about much more than personal gain or commercial success. It's about exploring what's possible, envisioning a better world, thinking beyond the paradigms of the present. In Tesla, he sees a man devoted to these principles, a visionary and a humanitarian, committed to improving people's lives through technological innovation. Through his work with the International Tesla Society, McGinnis hopes to spread a little bit of Tesla's ambition and creativity to the rest of us.
Within all of us, we have a vision. It's universal. Somewhere in your mind, you've got an idea. You've been toying with it for years. And what I'm telling you is take action. Get to work. And then finally, finish. And finish it good. Put that product out so that when it's laying in front of somebody else, they're looking at it and they're going, hey, that's beautiful.
We'll be right back with more Western Skies. Welcome back to Western Skies. I'm Andrea Chalfin. We've heard a lot about innovation in terms of invention and entrepreneurship, but that's not the only way in which innovation applies. I sat down with Nick Kittle and Jay Anderson of the Colorado Springs Office of Innovation and Sustainability to find out just how innovation works in city government. Nick begins the conversation with an explanation.
Innovation obviously covers a lot of different areas, especially inside of city government. But for us, we talk about innovation as supporting our citizens, supporting the financial health of the city, and supporting our environment. If it does those three things, we believe it's a sustainable innovation in the long run.
Part of my mission here at the city is to find and allocate the hidden cost of city services so that we can know the true cost. That feeds into a lot of the things that we do here, because we explore a lot of innovative ways of delivering city services, things that haven't been explored in the past.
Like what?
Part of the mayor's goals are taking a look at transforming city government. He's really big on job creation and connecting with our community. So when we look at, as part of our innovations, we focus on all those different areas in important ways. So as an example, when we talk about the transforming city government, we have a role in terms of supporting the innovations of our employees. Lots of times the employees have had great ideas, but they haven't had an outlet to have that heard. We have constructed a way to allow the employees to come to us, help field those ideas, and then put them forward as a mechanism where they can be heard. And then we create the forum and the environment for employees to innovate. And that allows us to harness their ideas as well. When we talk about building community, we've got an online presence that's separate from the cities but supported by the city. That's our Facebook page. Our entire team actually has our own personal Twitter accounts, and so we're really active in engaging with the public, especially the young entrepreneurs in our community and folks who are finding a way to plug into government.
Did Mayor Bach initiate this department?
When Mayor Bach came on board, he recognized that we have to find a different way to deliver services to our citizens. We keep doing what we've been doing, and we're going to keep getting what we've been getting. One of his major priorities is transforming city government. I think when you talk with most people, if you were to say, what is the least innovative section of this world? I think people would scream out government, top of the list. But yet we haven't, as a nation, prioritized innovation inside of our governments. That's weird to me. It's interesting, and from Mayor Bach's perspective, I think that's where he was coming from, too. We need to prioritize innovation and find ways to create different solutions to problems.
Jay.
And along those same lines, recognizing the value of innovation in government is something that is kind of a developing movement right now. You just had the launch of the, at the federal level, the Innovation Fellows program. There's also groups across the country that we've worked with, including the Mayor's Office of New Urban Mechanics in Boston and now in Philadelphia, as well as the Innovation Group in San Francisco, who we've been working with. We've been partnering with them and teaching each other lessons and learning from each other for, you know, the better part of a year.
When the idea for the department came up, how did you guys say, you know, this is what I want to do, I want to innovate?
Part of what we kind of did was we started off with, look, let's take a look at what other cities are doing, and then said, you know what, absolutely not. That's the wrong way to do this. When we look, if we take a look at other cities, we're not innovating. We're piggybacking, which is a great way to go about business at later points in time. People have all kinds of great ideas, but we actually sat down and holed up for a little bit and said, what is the method of innovation in Colorado Springs? So what we have done on a national level is completely different than the other innovation offices across this country. What we realized is that because of our fiscally conservative community, we wanted to talk about innovation value. And so we actually pioneered the concept of innovation value in government, which is talking about essentially efficiency value plus actual cost savings, creating innovation value. So we found a way to measure innovation and put numbers behind it.
One thing that we're able to do by putting a dollar value on innovations is to take innovations from any industry. So we can take value that we create in the streets department or in accounts receivable, and you know, we can combine them. And we're able to take both cost-saving measures in different units and also add them to the energy efficiency efforts that we also do in our office, where we've done energy efficiency retrofits or other work with Recovery Act dollars. And we're able to combine that with business process efficiency and come up with a total number that includes both sustainability efforts and business process innovation.
How would you explain to a resident what this office does? What would you say to them to help them understand the benefit of having such an office?
Well, I'll soundbite it. This is Nick. And I'll soundbite it for a second. What we say, because there's a lot of different opportunities where we plug in and really help support it. So we are Jacks and Janes of all trades in this office. But what I'll say is we help great people do great things. And that's really what this office is designed to do to some extent. We are the thing that makes tape sticky. We help support the internal people who want to go ahead and see a better way for government to be delivered. When ideas fall in the cracks between departments, we're there to go ahead and fill that crack and make sure that that idea, a great idea that just happens to be between two departments, doesn't get lost. When a person in the community has a great idea that they want to explore, it's easiest to come to us so they don't end up dying on the knife of bureaucracy, okay? So these are the ways that we end up creating opportunities for our citizens. And then when we talk about real dollar values, we have paid for ourselves in this office 123% this year.
How?
We have generated 14 different very specific cost savings metrics when we refer to innovation value. 14 different activities have contributed different amounts of money in terms of actual real cost savings back to the citizens, back to the general fund, and those have combined to create 123% of the value of what it takes to actually fund the office. So on an internal level, we focus on creating cost savings that are really tangible for the constituents of Colorado Springs, for our citizens, and really provide that value back. And then on an external level, we are the easiest place to plug into your government in some cases.
Jay?
I think it is very important to realize that we're trying to function in the community as an alternative point of access to local government. You know, we're plugged in. We're on social media. The conversations are happening about the city budget, about the performance of the government, about, you know, the local politics. It's happening. For us, being that part of government that's plugged in to these conversations that are going on in the community is natural and necessary.
In terms of how long this department has been in existence, how much money has it saved the city?
We're basically close to about $400,000 in savings, recognized in 2012 alone. The way that we recognize the savings is sort of year over year. Our goal has been to pay for ourselves every single year. So that's what we're trying to do, is demonstrate we create enough innovation, enough sustainovation in some cases, to go ahead and actually recover costs every single year. So we have recovered 123% of the value of what we need to for 2012. We have already, because of things like the future facility retrofits, that's going to pay next year too. So that's part of our 2013 savings also. So because of that, we've already paid for roughly 80% of ourselves in 2013. But over time, you need to add new innovations in there in order to continue to pay for yourself. So over time, these things have less and less value. And so you create a bigger and bigger gap. And then as a result of that, what we're trying to do is just go ahead and cover this distance and pay for ourselves on a yearly basis. In terms of total innovation value in 2012, the number is $2.75 million. But again, when we look at it on a year-to-year basis, which is kind of how we're trying to be conservative and intelligent about this, we're actually 123% funded already in 2012 and looking at a significant portion of our funding for 2013. And then hopefully, we'll innovate again and innovate again and innovate again until we find a way to make sure we're paid for in 2013, 2014, and 2015. But I also want to emphasize that the innovations that come out of this group don't always have paybacks. Sometimes they're just wild, fun, good, solid ideas that need to live on.
Such as?
Here's one we've got going right now, which is called 385. It's called 385 Intuition. But what it's designed to do is, you know, if I were to say right now, what's the number to call for a pothole? How many people can rattle that off the top of their head? I'm going to guess exactly zero of your listeners can probably name that number, except for the street guy who's in his truck right now, and he probably knows that number. But that number should be more intuitive. What if that number were 385 Road? What if the number, if you see a traffic sign or a traffic signal down, was 385 Sign? So finding a way to take as many of these different operations as we can, create an intuitive number so that a citizen, if they're seeing something and want to report it in the field, could actually take a guess at it and say, you know what, it's probably 385, I mean, I'm in a park, I'll try 385 Park. And it happens to go to the park, the Parks Department. It's one of these things that it's about making it easier for citizens to engage with their government. But again, it doesn't have an innovation value that we're going to put down on a spreadsheet and quantify. It's just about engaging the community in a different way.
Have any issues come to the forefront because of the Waldo Canyon fire or any of the flooding concerns that are out there now? I mean, have things sort of been pushed to the top because of those issues?
Our involvement with the Waldo Canyon fire was nearly complete. I think everyone in our office was taken away from their regular duties. Nick facilitated a lot of what needed to happen for the city involvement at the Joint Information Center and the Emergency Operations Center. And having been exposed in public works, or having run public works for a while, he was very knowledgeable about the infrastructure side of things. My involvement was I took over the Twitter accounts. I had talked with communications ahead of time and had gotten them using a social media dashboard before the fire happened. So once I got involved on Sunday morning, I was able to take over the dashboard, and anyone who came in any agency that got involved with the Joint Information Center, I immediately asked them for their Twitter handle and password, and I took them over. So yeah, it was the police department, the fire department, the mayor, the city, county health, and the sheriff's office, and all of the unified messaging. That was because our office is we're versed and comfortable in social media, not just the use of it, but strategic use.
You know, you talk a lot about social media. You talk about bringing the community and getting the community involved, having given them access to their city government. But I don't feel like the Office of Innovation is very visible. How do you reach out to people? How do you encourage them to engage the city? If, you know, the last check, there were 400 people, 450 people who liked your Facebook page. You know, that doesn't seem like a lot to me. So how are you getting the message out that this office is here and ready to listen to you?
We've tried to reach out to both sides. We talk about innovation and sustainability. The sustainability side is a little easier to reach out to, just because there are organizations in the community that we're already plugged into. So as far as increasing the number of fans or increasing our exposure in the community, it's been a lot easier to reach out on that side. But we also hit them on, once they're fans on our Facebook page, we also let them know about some of the business process improvements that we're working on. So, you know, we work on both sides. We work on sustainability and we work on process improvement. And so far, that message, the combined message has landed.
Part of this is making sure that people know that we're there, but what we want to do is be known through our work. And so as people say, okay, well, wait a second, I plugged into them and they totally got it done for me. Our hope is that we spread through word of mouth a little bit. Our Facebook and social media are helping us get there, just because that's a different way to engage people. But again, when you kind of exist out of nothing and then, you know, start to gain it, it takes a little time to get the flywheel moving.
That was Jay Anderson and Nick Kittle of the Colorado Springs Office of Innovation and Sustainability. You can see more online at krcc.org. And finally, the Forest Service is showing a little innovation of its own to help clean up land damaged by coal mining. They're partnering with a cattlemen's association in the far reaches of Pitkin County to repair damages from the coal basin mine outside Redstone. The mine stopped operating 20 years ago. Aspen Public Radio's Marcy Krivenin set out to see how bovine behavior could help clean up nearby land.
High above a busy highway in a picturesque alpine basin, a group of cows ambles across a plot of land. At first glance, it's hard to see, but these cows are actually helping repair the land. The fenced plot they're walking on is covered in straw and hay with seeds underneath. As they saunter across, their hooves push the seeds into the soil, making fast vegetative growth possible.
We're hoping that with the straw and hay and the cows kind of churning that soil up, that we can actually create a soil structure. We can hold more water in the soil, and we can get better nutrient cycling.
Ben Carlson is a range technician with the Forest Service. The land the cows are on is an old refuse pile. When the mine was active, waste was thrown here. Now the dirt is hard-packed, almost like a parking lot, Carlson says, as he hikes up the steep pile.
When they process coal, they get a bunch of waste rock out of it. And they just put it in a pile, throw a little bit of topsoil over it, and then seed it.
That's what this is.
Yeah, basically.
The Coal Basin Mine is one of more than 20,000 abandoned mines statewide. Many leak toxins into local watersheds. The concern here is about sediment. Leftover mine workings turned the soil into an impenetrable sheet. Now it refuses to soak up water. Sharon Clark with the Roaring Fork Conservancy says when it rains, dirt flows across the landscape and into streams. The results, she says, show up in local rivers.
This year, I think anybody that's looked at the Crystal River has seen just massive amounts of sediment.
Increased sediment is bad news for the aquatic life in these streams.
And so all that sediment's, you know, going to hurt the fish, the macroinvertebrates, and, you know, going to reduce the complexity of the system. So there's nothing good about it.
Across the state, 1,300 miles of streams are impaired because of past mining activities, according to the Colorado Division of Reclamation Mining and Safety. Funding to repair these lands and improve the watersheds is minimal, so collaborations like this one are often essential. In Coal Basin, the Forest Service, Roaring Fork Conservancy, and the local Cattlemen's Association are working together. Still, the work is happening on a small scale, on just 1 acre. Clark says much more work is needed here. She points to another big waste pile across the way on the property.
That whole pile across the way there, that all needs revegetation. You know, you can see that there has been some attempts at revegetation, but if you look at, you know, some of those trees there, they were probably planted, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and they're, you know, just over your knee. It's not the best conditions for growing.
On the land parcel being worked by the cows, the hope is grass will grow high here by next year. It's an experiment, but if it works, much of this scarred landscape could be repaired. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Marcy Krivenin.
Me, oh my, oh my, I'm looking at the western sky.
Thanks for joining us this month for Western Skies. We'll see you again next month. We want to hear from you. What's on your mind? Send us an email at westernskies@krcc.org or give us a call at 719-434-3657. Western Skies is a production of KRCC News and The Big Something with producers Andrea Chalfin, Craig Richardson, and Noel Black. Special thanks to The Haunted Wind Chimes for our theme music with lyrics and arrangement by Anea Lujan. For KRCC News and Western Skies, I'm Andrea Chalfin.